There have been ugly rumors that your men wish to withdraw and let all these witches kill each other. I know you feel compelled to be here, Overlord Rotans. So I wish to drop the compulsion now. And I do so hereby. Overlord, I freely grant you the 15-year lease to the Cenarian lands for your use. I hereby release you from fielding an army and putting them at my service.
What?
He wasn't the only one incredulous at the table. Without the Lycanaut's 5,000, the armies would be seriously weakened. Logan held up one finger, and the Overlord sat up, sure this was the teeth of the trap.
I only ask that if you wish to withdraw from this fight, that you declare your intentions immediately, so that we may know how much of an army we will have.
That's all?
It was too fair a request for him to protest. Logan didn't want the Lycanaut fielding the army and then melting away at the first Caladoran charge. He still looked puzzled, so he hadn't seen the teeth of Logan's offer yet, and the damned fool was about to speak. He was going to accept the offer if Ariel didn't do something.
I'm only a woman, but it seems to me that such cowardice will make recruitment a challenge in a few countries. Let's see. Cenaria, of course, will feel betrayed. Cura, too. Oh, and I doubt the Praetor will be impressed, so definitely Alitara. That's a tough one to lose. Waedrin and Modai may still send recruits. Pity they're so small.
And their people so historically reluctant to die for the light of reason.
And this is such a bad time to have trouble with recruitment.
Why is that?
Some superstition in Ezra's Wood recently slew 5,000 Lycanaut.
That's some superstition.
You are vile, all of you. You are friends of the darkness.
There's the crux. You see, friends, the Lycanaut have no country. They have only ideas. If they abandon us, they can survive the allegations of betrayal and cowardice. What will cut them is hypocrisy. They can betray us. What they can't betray is their principles. Today we faced perhaps 100 Meisters, but this God King Wanhope brought 2,000. Where were the rest?
Do you actually know the answer to that question?
We passed a town called Rygukas on our way up the river. It was dead. From the magic still in the air, hundreds, perhaps thousands of Meisters worked for at least 12 hours raising Krull. Those Krull then devoured the city's inhabitants. Tomorrow we will face actual, real creatures of darkness, Overlord. I'd estimate their numbers to be in excess of 20,000.
Shit! There goes our 20,000 Sakurai advantage.
That one Sakurai is not offset by one Krull.
Do you even know what a Krull is?
The point is, when they have a chance to fight the spawn of darkness, the world will see that the Lycanaut are hypocrites who prefer to turn tail.
Go to hell! Go to hell, all of you! Tomorrow, you will see how the Lycanaut fight. We will take the center of any charge. I will lead it myself!
A generous offer. We accept, with the caveat that I ask you not to lead any charge yourself. I'm afraid, Overlord Rotans, that there are simply too many who would wish to see you fall in battle.
The obvious target of the comment was the Magi. But Sister Ariel saw that what Logan feared was the Lycanaut's own men, who were doubtless chafing at having to fight beside witches. If Julius Rotans fell, the Lycanaut would retreat. In offering an honorable exit from rash words, or had the Overlord actually hoped to die and thereby allow his men to retreat and the Cenarians and everyone else to be betrayed and slaughtered, Logan Geyer not only kept the Overlord alive and his army at Logan's disposal, he also might have regained some goodwill from the man who, if nothing else, had shown that he was willing to talk. Sometimes the devil you knew was better than the one you didn't. Sister Aria looked at Logan Geyer with newfound respect. In this meeting of kings and magi, praetors and overlords, he had taken command without the least effort. He must have had some intelligence of a Lycanaut betrayal, or he wouldn't have brought the matter up. Now he had effectively defanged the threat and managed to look magnanimous doing it.
Now, before we discuss the specifics of our disposition on the battlefield, does anyone have anything else to add? Sister Viridiana?
Logan looked at V, who looked like she'd been on the verge of offering something for a while.
There was an explosion of magic earlier this afternoon on the other side of Black Barrow. Our source said there was a fight between the God King's Meisters and a bunch following one of his rivals, a man named Moburu Ursul.
May the gods see fit to send the traitor's soul to hell on the edge of my sword.
Moburu is claiming to be some prophesied High King. Apparently, he seems to fulfill the conditions. I didn't think anything of it until the regent said that making Lantana a king would clear the way for a High King.
Sister Ariel wondered if her own face was as pale as everyone else's around the table. She probably knew more about the High King than any of them, but it had never occurred to her that it might be a Caladoran who fulfilled the prophecy.
You said Moburu fought the God King. Who won?
Moburu was driven to Black Barrow.
In our prophecies, when Kura has a king once more, that king will fight beside the High King. I will never fight beside this Moburu. This I swear on my soul.
That's good enough for me. In Alaterra, the prophecies of a High King speak of days of turmoil and woe, so I don't envy you the trouble the next decades may visit on you. But I think that's one problem we may safely dismiss for now.
Sister Viridiana, you said you had two things.
V glanced at Sister Ariel.
I'm not actually a full sister yet. Anyway, I'm sorry to bring a personal matter before this council, but does anyone know where Eileen Cromwell is?
No one showed any sign of recognition.
That name sounds familiar. Who is she?
She's Kylar's wife. And he's going to come for her.
Logan's face lost all color. Everyone else looked curious but unknowing, except for Solon and Fear, who both looked afraid. Afraid of Kyla? Regardless, they knew him. Sister Ariel's fear was for V. The damned fool girl had casually spilled a truth that could spell her own destruction.
Oh, by the way, I'm not married to Kyla.
If Logan had proved how excellent he was at this kind of counsel, V had shown herself to stand at the antipodes.
You're right. That's a more personal matter. I'll speak with you about that later. Are there any questions?
I have some. What if Black Barrow isn't meant to keep things out? What if it's meant to keep something in? What if Moburu wasn't driven there? What if he went to get something?
Oh, gods.
The armies formed up while it was still dark. Stomach knotted with tension, Logan tended to his horse, checking the straps a third time. The Allied armies were stretched left and right, extended further and deeper than anything he'd ever seen. The Lycanauts 5,000 would lead the charge. Behind them, 20,000 Cenarian infantry would take the center, flanked by 20,000 Sakurai. Lantano Garawashi's original 5,000 Sakurai would secure the forest to the west to make sure the Caladorans didn't have any nasty surprises hiding there, and if possible, sweep from the forest into the God King's camp. 1,000 of V's shield sisters would hold the dam and the bridges from magical attacks. The other 7,000 had spread out among the armies according to a logic they didn't deign to share with Logan. The 2,000 Alateran light cavalry and 1,000 Sethi light infantry would be their reserves. Much would depend on the first Lycanaut charge. With 20,000 Krull added to their ranks, the Caladorans would have 45,000 to stand against the Allies' 53,000, or 60,000 if one counted the Shield Sisters. The Caladorans would have their backs to the dead Daime. If the first Lycanaut charge could shatter them against it, the army could be halved and separated from command. Of course, no one really knew how Krull fought. The Magi had offered centuries-old accounts of brutes with great strength, poor eyesight, and an inability to feel pain. That last was the most worrying.
Your Majesty, do you remember last month when you went down to the hole again?
Logan made it a habit to go every month. He was sorry to inflict it on his bodyguards, but he hadn't stopped. Logan looked at Aurella, sitting a horse, holding her sword like she knew what to do with it now. She was one of the few women of the Order of the Garter who'd chosen to join Logan's bodyguard rather than go back to their lives after Pavel's Grove. Logan hadn't been surprised when Garawashi had singled her out as a natural talent with the sword. Not as strong as a man, he'd said pointedly, but damn good for a woman. Aurella had wisely chosen not to take offense.
You asked me what kind of idiot I was to keep going down to that hell, when it gives me nightmares every time.
You told me it was to prove nightmares had no power over you.
You're making me nervous.
I think you should mount, sire.
Logan mounted. The gloom of night was lifting by slow degrees, revealing nothing more than the deeper blackness of the dead Daimane advancing toward them. It took Logan far too long to understand what he was seeing. It was Krull. Bodies, dark gray or mottled black or even white, loping forward in a massive wave. There had to be 80,000 Krull alone. The Kaladoran army was at least 100,000 strong, and every one of them stood between Logan and his wife. His right arm tingled as rage washed over him.
V! Give me light!
Lux Exeunt!
There was a rush, and when he looked, a white fireball was arcing out over the plain, and it froze in midair. Moments later, a dozen more followed from points all along the line, illuminating the charging Krull, who'd already closed half the distance.
Signal ready!
Another Maja in V's cadre gestured, and a magical version of the signal flag flew into the air over Logan's head, glowing and big enough for the entire army to see.
Advance!
Came through the pass as the armies on the plains below sprinted the last paces toward each other. He was too far away to hear the crash, but he could see the shock of it passing through the ranks. He continued running, not slowing as he passed the camp followers who had gathered to watch the battle, many of them carrying all their possessions in case the battle turned out badly. He lost sight of the battle as he sprinted down the valley. Those few armed men he encountered, he passed before they could raise a challenge until he got to Black Bridge. There, half a dozen men with pikes and short swords at their belts turned from the battle to watch his approach.
Hold!
As Kyler stopped in front of them, a crack like thunder shook the earth. Kyler was the only one who kept his feet. He turned his eyes to Black Barrow. The slight rises and dips of the plain between him and the Great Dome were covered with warriors, both human and Krull. But the battle slowed as those not in the front line looked to the great shining black sphere. This time, jagged cracks raced from the highest point of the dome down its sides. The third crack shattered the dome from inside. Huge chunks of black rock, 3 feet thick, exploded into the air and rained onto the dead Daimane in the battlefield, crushing Krull and men alike. Most of the dome still stood, quivering, edges sharp around the hole in its crown. The rest of the dome fell in, raising a huge cloud of black dust, like a stain of night across the morning. Something huge moved inside it.
What is that?
Kyler was already running. Most of the fighting men had noticed nothing. The grim business of war took all their attention. The Allies' armies were doing extremely well if what Kyler had seen of their relative numbers was accurate. He saw one of Agon's archers fit an arrow to his Yumuri bow and shoot. 200 paces away, one of the Kaladoran signal flags went up in flames. It was obviously on purpose, because only one or two Kaladoran signal flags remained on the entire plain. Kyler wondered briefly whose good idea that had been. Kurok was still strapped to his back, and the black Kakari concealed it. Kyler drew neither as he closed with the rear of the Cenarian line. His leap took him over the first 6 lines of Krull. Kyler read the bodies of those among which he would land. 5 black creatures and 1 a diseased, flaky white that seemed their leader. 2 saw him. Kyla tucked his knees to his chest, flipped, then threw his feet forward at the last second. His feet connected with a big black crawl over its eyes. The white was taller than the others, more than 6 feet, and recovered first, swinging a huge dull blade at Kyla. Kyla dodged it and crushed the white's throat with a kick. Kyla darted behind another, grabbed its horns and broke its neck before he realized that perhaps a dozen black crawl weren't moving at all. They simply stared at the dying white leader. He pulled a tanto from his belt and jammed it into the white crawl's heart. What little light had been in the piggish eyes around him guttered out. The 10 crawl looked lost. For 3 impossible seconds, they didn't move. Kyla could sense them searching for something. Then, as if each had been yanked on a leash toward a new master, the crawl bolted in 10 different directions. A jolt of fear more intense than any he'd ever felt lashed through Kyla's bond with V. She was 200 paces to his left. Kyla ran through the dead dye main over corpses that looked oddly fresh but didn't stink. He was behind the main line of crawl, but there were still hundreds that saw him. His talent filled him like a fire. He was a blur. As always, he could feel V more intensely the closer he got. She was in the middle of a thick knot of fighting. The sheer volume of magic was astounding. Magi flanked V, and they faced a dozen Verdmeisters with Veer clawing through every inch of exposed skin. On a white charger, in white enameled armor, Logan and a score of his bodyguards faced dozens of monsters. A great sword-toothed cat leapt for the king. Logan slashed his sword into the top of its head. Its claws scored his horse's armor as it fell dead. A squat red crawl, a head shorter than most of its kin but 3 times as wide, with skin that looked like it was entirely made of bone, grabbed a horse's leg. It fell, spilling one of Logan's bodyguards to the ground. He stabbed it. His blade bowed but then pierced the creature's skin. It ignored it and grabbed his arm, then his face. Nasher grabbed the man's other arm and tried to pull him up onto his horse. The crow grabbed the man by the head. Nasher kept pulling, not understanding the guard was already dead. Greenish crawl with splayed legs like frogs leapt at Logan, trying to knock him from his saddle. V blasted them aside with talent, and bodyguards opened their throats. As Logan's knot of warriors ground slowly toward the dead dye main, a Verdmeister beyond the fighting chanted. Kyla saw the sword-toothed cat's split head mend, and moments later it stood. Everywhere the scene was repeated. The Verdmeisters were instantly replacing the most powerful brawl they lost. Kyla unlimbered Kurok and decapitated that Verdmeister. Through the press of bodies, he saw V. A crawl claw slapped onto her arm, but bounced off as her blood-red dress hardened like armor. She sliced off the crawl's arm and met Kyla's eyes. She pointed behind him. It was the Titan. It had cracked open Black Barrel, and now it was coming to war. The sheer size of it was hard to believe. It was shaped almost like a man, its skin a cool, luminous blue under scale armor, its hair gold and short and spiky like an unruly boy's, its eyes black with silver vertical irises like a cat's, its muscles smooth and beautiful. But if it was a god from the front, it was a demon from behind. Huge spikes extended from its spine, reptilian wings draped from its shoulders, and a rat-like hairy tail dragged behind it. It wielded a spiked pole as a cudgel.
Kylar! Kill it!
He could feel her intimately enough to know she hadn't meant to invoke the bond, but she'd done it anyway.
sideways.
Like he'd been lashed with a cat of nine tails, his attention focused instantly, irrevocably on the Titan. He had no choice. Caldrosa Wynn was lying in the shadow of a huge Krull corpse. This one was shaped like a bear with scabby, pale skin devoid of fur. She was near the crest of a hill in the Dead Dymane, north of Black Barrow, or north of where Black Barrow had been. The dome had come down minutes earlier, scaring the hell out of her. From her position, she could see several hundred of the other soldiers. Most of them were Sakurai, the rest were Agam's dogs. She'd come because her husband Tommen had. And if he was going to take a mission this dangerous, she was going with him. It was time. Caldrosa pulled the muddy bag at her feet up and opened it. She dressed slowly, carefully, trying to work blood into her stiff arms and legs. They'd been crawling and lying in muck for 2 days. It was a wonder she could move at all. They'd blackened their armor and weapons so they wouldn't reflect sunlight, but she was still as quiet as possible. They didn't want to spoil their gambit this close to its fruition. The Ymuri bows were the biggest problem. To string them, the Ymuri warmed them by a fire for at least half an hour. That wasn't an option. Someone had foreseen it, though, and the archers gathered around an odd, cold Modaini magus named Antoninus Wervil. Otaru Tomaki, one of Lantano Garawashi's advisors, was in command. Caldrosa didn't know what he'd seen to make him decide they should attack now, or if he had seen anything. Tightening the last stubborn leather strap between Toman's shoulder blades with numb fingers, she poked her head over the bear, not shrinking from its touch. Her horror at the monsters had peaked the first night. Now the monsters were just meat, and oddly unstinking meat at that. The Kaladoran command tent seemed almost abandoned. There were a score of rich pavilions in a rough circle, but only a half dozen guards patrolled the area, and they focused on a pavilion beside the largest one. 4 female Meisters stood around it. That confirmed it for Caldrosa. It was the concubine's pavilion. The Dead Dymane ended 100 paces from the pavilions. Tommen and the other archers were creeping as close as they could. She knew Tommen would make the shot from 200 paces, but they didn't want to take chances. Everything depended on being quick and lethal. Turning to sit against the bear, she stretched her arms and rolled her head. South of her hill, the black dust from the dome was settling in the city that had been hidden beneath Black Barrow. In the center was an expansive white castle. The city itself was at the highest point of the plain, so Caldrosa could see nothing of the battle beyond it. She pulled on her helmet and turned in time to see every guard and Meister in sight tumble to the ground with arrows stuck in them. Suddenly, 1,000 men jumped to their feet and ran toward the pavilions. The Sakurai usually shouted war cries, but now they were silent. 100 Sakurai ringed the pavilion that had been guarded, while the others fanned out. On the count Tamaki had given, they cut through the walls of the pavilion on 4 sides simultaneously and stormed in. By the time Caldrosa arrived, maybe 5 seconds later, the 6 eunuchs inside the tent were dead, and the lone woman was ringed by wary Sakurai. The woman was dark-haired, of a slender build, maybe 16. She was dressed richly and held a sword, waving it wildly.
Get away! Stay back!
It struck Caldrosa that 100 Sakurai were probably not the kind of rescuers a Sonarian princess would expect.
Your Highness, be calm. We're here to save you. We've come from your husband.
My husband? What madness is this? Stay back!
You're Janine Gaia, aren't you?
Otaru Tamaki gave the signal.
Time! We've got to go!
Janine Gaia? That's been one of my names.
King Logan sent us. He's missed you terribly, Your Highness. You're the reason we're here.
Logan? Logan's dead!
Their puzzled looks must have convinced her it was no trap. She went white.
Logan's alive? The Sonarian king? Oh, gods!
The sword tumbled from her fingers. She passed out. Otaru Tamaki caught her before she hit the floor. He hoisted her over a shoulder.
Good work. Easier this way.
I've never seen someone actually swoon. Very well. Are we ready?
30 seconds.
Caldrosa counted. At 30, Antoninus Wervil extended his hands to the sky, and a blue flame whooshed out, turning green at its apex. Then they waited. A tense minute later, an answering green flare arced into the sky from the opposite side of Black Barrow.
We go east, through the dead domain. Go!
In a tumult of clashing arms, grunts, curses, clashing sword on sword or sword on shield, the thump of cudgels hitting flesh, the muted crack of breaking limbs or shattering skulls, the whistle of air escaping from a throat instead of a mouth, the familiar stench of blood and bile and death-loosened bowels, and the sweat of exertion and the sweat of fear, Kylo was suddenly serene. He kicked low into a white crow's chin, snapping. He slid past the falling beast, lunged to slide Kurok into another crow's throat, reversed his grip on the sword, and stabbed it through the right crow's skull before it hit the earth. Its death and the sudden slackness in the crow nearest him gave Kylo a moment to look at the Titan. It had reached the thick of the fight, 100 paces away. It swept its spiked club in a savage swath. Krull and men alike were lofted into the air, pierced by spikes longer than swords and then flung free on its next slash. Kylo plunged back into the maelstrom like a diver into a cool lake on a blistering day. A dark facsimile of a Harani bull reared up before Kylo, lashing stump-like feet, slashing mighty tusks. Kylo dodged backward, hesitated until it was about to land on all fours, then dove beneath it. Kurok passed through the bull's abdomen like a comb passing through a princess's hair on the 100th stroke. It was beautiful. He'd acquired a stabbing spear somewhere, and now he spun into another knot of crawl. He stopped killing the black crawl half the time, focusing on the whites, the bears, the aurochs, and the Harani bulls, anything that was in his path to the Titan. When the Titan was less than 30 paces away, for the first time, Kylo had a cut parry. This crawl was different from any he'd yet seen. While most Krulls seem to be crafted on the idea that stronger is better, bigger is best, this creature was man-shaped and as lean as Kylo. Instead of skin, it had a blood-red chitin exoskeleton. Its face was a featureless chitin oval. It held 2 swords of the same material and stood in a perfect ready stance. Inevitably, Kurok punched through its chitinous chest. Kylo decapitated it to be sure, and saw that the exoskeleton red warriors were the only Krull around the Titan. The Titan was as tall as 7 or 8 men, and neither stupid nor slow. Where the cavalry bunched, it killed 6 horses and men in a single swipe. The Titan lifted a foot to stomp on a horseman charging him, and the ants scattered. Kylo leapt through the gap. The Titan's foot came down, crushing man and horse to jelly. Kylo jumped and grabbed its cap. The Titan wore scale armor made of scales so big that Kylo didn't dare imagine what they had come from. But the straps holding the armor together were thick leather and enormous hemp ropes. With Kurok's shield, Kylo clambered up to the Titan's belt. The Titan noticed him and spun so fast Kylo's feet lost their grip and swung out horizontally. Kylo saw chitin warriors crushed by the unexpected move. The Titan swatted at him, and Kylo was batted into the folds of its furled wings. Cocooned in soft, stinking leather, Kylo slipped toward the ground. He grabbed a wing bone as thick around as his thigh. He climbed as quickly as he could, and Kurok came to hand as the Titan noticed that he was still hanging on. Kylo slashed once, twice, 3 times, and the soft, hand-thick membrane parted. He slapped Kurok onto his back and slipped through the hole as the Titan unfurled its enormous wing. Caught halfway through the wing, Kylo was almost knocked unconscious by the whiplash. The Titan furled its wings to try to shake him loose again, and Kylo pushed through and jumped. He caught himself on one of the huge spines protruding from the Titan's back. The Titan spun again, but didn't see him, and then was distracted by some attack Kyla couldn't see. Kyla's feet found purchase on a lower spine, and timing the movements of the Titan's body, Kyla clambered from spine to spine. There was nowhere to brace himself for a blow to cut into the Titan's spine, so Kyla kept climbing until he reached the broad gorget that protected the Titan's neck. A fringe of metallic hair protruded over it, and Kyla grabbed a handful, bracing himself to ram Kurok into the back of the Titan's head. Magic arced through the metallic hairs and blasted him off his feet. Kyla spun, hanging by one hand. He lost his grip and caught the gorget itself, his hand between the metal and the Titan's skin. Kyla swung around and hacked blindly into the Titan's neck. Magic burst from the Titan in a shockwave. The world went black, and Kyla felt himself spinning into space. There was nothing to grab, no possible way to stop his fall, and from this height, falling would surely be lethal. It was like a dream. The rush of air, the sick emptiness in his stomach, the twist as he braced for the inevitable impact. But he didn't wake up. Crushed something and heard as much as he felt his bones snapping. His collarbone, right arm, every rib on the right side and his pelvis crunched and cracked. When he blinked, his eyes clear, he was flat on his back. Kyla tried to move, but there was no way. Pain arced through him, so intense that black spots swam in front of his eyes. If he tried again, he'd black out. He was dead. Just like that, Kyla's battle was finished. The Titan had staggered back several huge steps. Its neck was fountaining blood from the right side. Kyla had caught its carotid artery. Then it caught sight of Kyla. If Kyla could read emotion in those silver and black cat's eyes, he would have thought he read satisfaction. The Titan stepped forward. It was dying, and it knew it. And it was going to fall on top of Kyla to crush him. Kyla extended one finger to the Titan and lay back and looked at the sky. A speck floated in front of his eyes, and he blinked, but it didn't go away. In the sky, diving from mountainous heights, was a bird of prey, diving at great speed. Even in a dive, it was clear it must have had a 30-foot wingspan. And it was diving straight at Kyla.
Great. Crushed by a Titan or some huge bird. Beautiful.
There was no question of moving. So many bones were broken that breathing was excruciating. Kyla looked back at the Titan. The blood fountain from its neck still gushed. It was rocking forward, its perfect white teeth bared at Kyla. The bird snapped its wings open at the last second and swooped into the Titan's face with bone-shattering force. The Titan's head whipped back and it dropped like a stone backward onto the lines of Krull. The allies surged forward. Kyla saw men and horses leaping over him. He'd barely closed his eyes when he felt magic sliding into him. With a pure and brutal hand, his bones were wrenched into place and reconstructed in rapid order. When the magic receded, Kyla lurched over and threw up. He hadn't even known he could be healed so quickly. Who else would have tried?
One of these times, you're really gonna have to save my life. This is really getting old. Oh, by the way, I thought I told you to hold on to this.
Kyla gaped up at Durzo. His master was extending Kurok to him. Durzo was wearing a huge pack on his back that extended several feet above his shoulders. Except it wasn't a pack.
Oh, hell no.
You cannot fly. Tell me you can't fly.
Hollow bones, changes to the heart and eyes if you want to see while you dive, careful reapportionment of body mass. It's a real bitch. Helps if you study dragons.
Dragons? No. Don't tell me.
Kyler stood, shaky from the vast amount of magic that had coursed through him.
I didn't think I could heal that fast.
Kyler cut off as Durzo's wings melted into his back, and his form subtly changed proportion. Durzo had taught him that shifting his features, even the relatively minor shifts from one human face to another, took 8 to 12 hours. Now, his master had lost 30-foot wings in a matter of seconds.
Unbelievable.
It's too hard for you.
Do you know where Aline is?
Not for sure, but I know where the party is.
Durzo looked like he was about to say more, but he stopped. His face drained of humor. A moment later, Kyler caught what dismayed his master. By degrees, the ground beneath them seemed to sigh. The stench of the newly dead was magnified tenfold. Jorson's spell locking the ground had been broken. The dead Dimane shook off its chains and breathed. God King Wanhope saw the Cenarian flare arc high over his command tents, and his heart stopped.
Janine.
They were taking Janine. He stood on the last flight of steps before a great dome of the ancient castle. It was the tallest building he'd ever seen, with towering arches and flying buttresses that scraped the very heavens. Inside, he could feel Kali and Nafdada. Dorian was surrounded by a dozen Highlanders and 200 Verdmeisters, more than enough. The real battle would be between himself and Neff, his old tutor. Neff, who was making his play at usurpation. Neff, who had raised a titan and the red Bulgari, the fire ants, the bugs, which had been imprisoned near the titan. Nor was Nafdada the only one making a play. Wanhope's brother Maburu had spent almost all his strength in cutting through Wanhope's forces yesterday to get the Black Barrel. Now he was emerging from one of the tunnels under the city. He had a Ferali. From the stairs, the God King had advantage of everything north and east of the castle. To the north, he could see the small Cenarian force cutting through the dead Dimane to the east, where they would meet Logan Gyre's troops, led by the king himself. Maburu's force looked to be only a few hundred yards, and it would meet Logan's troops before the Cenarians who'd take Janine got there. Without the Ferali, the Cenarians would obliterate Maburu's force. With it, well, it depended on how good Logan's magi were. All in all, the resulting clash should give him plenty of time to go inside, take Kali, and cut off Neff from the Veer. Without Veer, Neff and Maburu would be helpless, and the entire army of Krull would finally be united. Wanhope had made mistakes, but the day was far from lost. He was turning to go inside when he saw Maburu's men turn and head for the Cenarians holding Janine. His heart pounded. He'd seen this scene as his gift came back. Maburu's Ferali would demolish the kidnappers and would seize Janine. Wanhope saw the picture vividly. Maburu held Janine, his eyes wild, a spell wrapped around her head that would crush it like a melon if he released it. It was too late for Janine. Wanhope could see her head popping, brain squirting out of the narrow holes in the spell. He blinked. Even if he saved her, his marriage was finished. The Cenarians had taken her. She must know now that Logan was alive. If he rescued her within sight of Logan, would she thank him for it? Inside, at least, was power. With Kali, Wanhope had magic, wealth, every pleasure of the flesh, comfort. There was the study of lost things, of magics no one could teach but a goddess. There was everything but friendship, companionship, love. But what were those things if he was going to go mad and couldn't enjoy them anyway? This was his birthright, and people had been trying to take his birthright for as long as he'd lived. He'd given everything to be here. What would happen to his harem if he left? He'd given those girls a decent life, a better life than they could have imagined. He couldn't live without the beer. He'd quit it once, and quitting had nearly killed him. He couldn't do it again. Janine was dead to him anyway. Besides, he wanted to crush Neff, to teach him finally who was the master and who was the student, to avenge all the cruelties Neff had inflicted upon him growing up. One hope turned to go inside.
Dorian! Dorian!
In the cobblestone street 100 paces away, Solon emerged around a corner riding a chestnut destrier. He gestured with one hand to what must have been soldiers in the street behind him, telling them to stop.
Dorian! My God, Dorian, it's good to see you! I thought you were dead.
God King Wanhope was wearing his white robes and heavy gold chains of office. The veer were darkening his skin, and Solon pretended not to see any of it. Solon rode toward him, not touching his talent, not holding any weapon, not making any move that might seem threatening, as if he were approaching a wild animal.
It is you, Dorian.
He said the word like it had power, like he was calling a dead man back to life. And it was life. Even with all the luxury and the fulfillment of every whim, Dorian had lived these last months hunted. There had been no rest, only stupor. There had never been communion, not even with Janine. The 200 Verdmeisters were getting nervous at Solon's approach. They could smell the potency of his talent, and even to Wanhope's nostrils it reeked. He hated it. It smelled of light, scouring, revealing, shaming light. But the Verdmeisters wouldn't attack Solon, not without the God King's word.
Dorian! Dorian!
Dorian had spoken a prophecy over Solon once. 10, 12 years ago, it ended...
Broken Lord, broken you, remade if you speak one word.
The cheeky bastard was asserting that the word was...
Dorian?
He was turning Dorian's own prophecy back on himself? Solon had a little grin twisting his lips in the way Dorian knew so well. He looked down the hill. Maburu had closed with the Cenarians holding Janine, and the Ferali was plowing through them in a cloud of black dust, tearing them apart, sticking their bodies to its flesh, growing. Inside, Neff was working to give Kali flesh. The goddess would enslave all Mid-Kiru, maybe all the world, enslave and destroy. Without a body, she had turned Kalidor into a cauldron of filth, a culture of fear and hatred. What could she do with a body? The best thing Dorian could do was stop him. God King Wanhope could stop Neff. He knew Neff. He knew how Neff would fight. The girl was a tangent, a distraction in the big picture. Dorian was too important. His skills too valuable to go after a girl when the real battle, the battle that would determine the fate of nations, perhaps all of Mid-Kiru, was only paces away. Dorian would go inside as God King Wanhope one last time. He would take the veer one last time and destroy all Neff had wrought. He would destroy Kali's works, and he would die. His fighting would be done at last. Unable to live well, he would at least die well. Besides, Janine was dead to him.
Dorian! Dorian, come back!
Janine was dead to God King Wanhope. She was dead even to Dorian. But she wasn't dead. This delusion was the same temptation that had snared him 100 times. Allow this present evil for some grand future good. To change an entire nation, to undo the evil his father had wrought. He had taken a harem, raised Krull, slaughtered children, raped girls, and started a war. In fact, he'd accomplished most of the things for which he hated his father, and in far less time. The truth was, Dorian had always been more interested in being known as good than in simply being good. And he was about to do it again. No wonder he'd been so willing to throw away his prophetic gift at Screaming Winds. He'd seen then what he was going to become. God King Wanhope turned to his Birdmeisters.
Go inside! Kill the usurper! I'll follow momentarily.
They went inside instantly. They might even obey. It didn't matter. He couldn't keep them here. they might try to stop him.
You too!
The bodyguards too obeyed instantly. With his stomach revolting at even touching his talent, weak and frail as it was, Dorian readied the weaves, not giving himself time to think. He knew these weaves. He'd used them once as a young man. It was probably too little, too late. There was no way he could pay for what he'd done. He should just smash Neff and die. No. That was the same old voice he'd obeyed too many times. Every time he decided to think about the temptation, he fell into the temptation. Now was the time to act, to simply do good, whether or not anyone ever knew it, whether or not it was enough. With as much talent as he could hold, he ripped the veer out of himself. Parts of his talent ripped away with it as he cut deep, deep. It ripped so many parts open that he knew he would never again control when his prophetic gift came or went. The madness he had feared and fought for so long would come, and it would stay forever. Finally, sickened, Dorian threw off the gold chains and the white cloak of his office.
Solon, friend, ride with me. Quickly, the madness comes.
Logan had no idea how the battle was going. Shortly after the signal had gone up that Janine had been recovered, and he'd committed himself to meeting those soldiers on the east side of the hill below the castle, flares had gone up behind them, calling for all of the reinforcements. But for the moment, none of it mattered. At the base of the hill, beneath the huge castle, the expedition Logan had sent to recover Janine was caught in a battle with a few hundred Caladorans. The ground here was covered with a black dust that was all that remained of Black Barrow. It had settled quickly, but as the forces fought and as Logan's men rode forward, they kicked it up once more, obscuring the battle. Logan and his foremost riders were within 30 paces when he saw something looming through the black dust. It was vaguely bear-shaped, but then men were stuck to its skin.
Break! Break! Ferrari!
He veered left. A crowd of Caladorans appeared out of the dust before him, all pressing to get away from the Ferrari. The Caladorans were panicked, totally unprepared for the sudden appearance of the cavalry, and Logan's line plowed through them. A vast arm, its skin writhing with gaping little mouths, passed over Logan's head, brushing his helmet. Logan couldn't see the rest of the creature except as a shadow against the lesser blackness of the dust. He lurched as a horse collided into the back of his destrier. It jarred him forward, and the men before him slowly yielded, either crushed or faces laid open from his destrier's teeth. Crackling ball of mage fire whizzed through the air and exploded against the Ferrari's hide, doing nothing. The Magi didn't know what they were facing. The force of Logan's charge pushed his men directly into the Ferrari. Logan found horses wedged to either side of him, Nasher on one side, me on the other, her red dress glowing from within as she hurled a flurry of fist-sized fireballs, some into the Caladorans back before them, and some at the Ferrari.
Invictus Destrio! It's not doing anything!
The Ferrari suddenly disappeared, hunkering down into the air.
Ah, shit!
Logan had seen this before. The Ferrari wasn't leaving or hiding. It was rearranging itself to use all its new meat. The press of the lines pushed men toward it. The Ferrari
Morali exploded upward, and men and horses were flung into the air in every direction.
Spread out! Spread!
Illuminatis!
Lee threw off a flare, but Logan bet no more than 100 men saw it. Suddenly, he saw magic rippling through the air over his head, diffuse as a cloud. The magic plunged to the ground. Within a square, 100 paces on each side, the black dust dropped to the earth and was held there. The air was clear. Logan looked up the hill and saw the source of the magic, Solon Tofusen, the man he thought he'd known for a decade. He stood with a dark-haired man on a promontory. The other mage was crackling with light, weaving a dozen strands of magic. Logan barely registered their presence before looking back to the battle. He saw that they were caught in what had been an estate's garden. There were walls on two sides. It was toward those walls that Logan had been trying to retreat. The Ferali sat in the middle. It had foregone legs to simply squat with half a dozen arms, plucking men and horses from the ground indiscriminately. And if the clear air helped Logan and his forces, it helped the Ferali too.
Second! Third! Fourth battalions! Circle behind!
Illuminatis!
Me threw up the signal, but getting an army to change direction wasn't a quick process. The 4th Battalion might arrive in time to stop the Caladoran force from retreating, but nothing could save the 1,000 men trapped with Logan in this garden.
Invictus Destrio!
Me began attacking the Ferali again, but now she was throwing a stream of balls of light toward the Ferali's eyes. She wasn't trying to hurt it now, merely blind it, distract it, slow its killing. In moments, a dozen other magi followed her lead, and dazzling streams of light flowed toward the great armed blob in the garden's center. For moments, it was paralyzed. Then it picked up a horse from the Caladoran side of the garden, where it could still see. It hurled the horse toward one of the magi, crushing her and a half a dozen others. Logan craned his neck to see how much the press had eased. Not enough.
Devine!
It was the man on the promontory with Solon, and it was a cry of utter despair. His arms were spread out, each hand swimming with intricate weaves. Logan wondered for a brief moment how he saw them. He'd never been able to see magic weaves before. Then the man brought his hands together, squeezing the weaves into one ball.
The end has come!
Magic leapt from his hand like an arrow and hit the Ferali. And unbelievably, stuck. The magic never stuck to Ferali. The Ferali was lifting another horse from the Caladoran side of the circle. There was a woman in the saddle, clambering back, trying to throw herself off the back of the horse, but the Ferali's hand was clamped over her dress.
Janine!
Logan's heart jumped into his throat, but there was nothing he could do.
Back to the darkness, beast!
The man on the promontory's hands went taut, like a rope tied to the Ferali. The horse dropped from the Ferali's hand, and Logan lost sight of his wife. The Ferali's gray skin was shimmering in a wave of black smoke. The skin evaporated. The Ferali slumped, died, then burst apart. Logan's heels were into his destrier before the Ferali's last arm hit the earth. He rode over mounds of stinking entrails and crashed into the first Caladorans he saw between him and where Janine had fallen. Logan caught a glimpse of the 4th Battalion coming into place and sealing the northern exit from the garden. A Ledeshian and 24 men had dismounted and climbed down to a raised stone balcony. The mansion the balcony had been attached to was a ruin, but the balcony itself was pristine, commanding views of the whole garden. The Ledeshian raised his arms and threw fire into the sky. It faded slowly until it burned around him, forming the outline of a dragon.
Behold! The High King is come! King Gaia! Come! Make your obeisance!
Maburu had no more than 30 men left, all of them stuck on the balcony with him. Logan ran up the steps. When he reached the top, he saw Janine. Her rich velvet clothing was torn and dirty, smeared with black dust like soot. But she appeared uninjured. Her arms were bound to her side, and a spell sat around her neck and head, with vicious teeth dimpling her skin. The jaws were held open only by a thin leaf Maburu held. If Maburu were killed, the jaws would snap shut and crush her skull. Logan didn't question how he knew it, but he did. Seeing Janine, Logan's heart surged with a mix of feelings too powerful for words. To see her alive after giving up hope took his breath away. No one would take Janine away from him again. No one would hurt her. Logan held up his hand, forestalling those following him from attacking Maburu.
It is written! He passeth through hell and waters below, and rises, mocked with death. Mocked with the moon dragon gaze, in the shadow of the death, of the barrel of man's last hope, he rises, and fire attends his bath. I tell you, this prophecy is fulfilled this day in your sight. I, Maburu Usul, son of the north, rightful god king, rise this day to take my throne. Pretender, I challenge you! Your crown against mine and her life!
Done! Hand over the death spell to one of your witches.
What? Your Majesty, we have him! He's got nowhere to go!
No interference!
Done!
And done!
Maburu turned and handed over the weave to a Verdmeister at his left. Logan tore off his helmet and pulled the crown from it. He tossed it to the same man.
Janine! I love you! I won't let them have you!
The battle had ended. There were no Kaladorans left to kill here.
I was born on the day foretold. 22 years ago. I bear the signs!
Maburu raised his right arm and displayed a glittering green tattoo reminiscent of a dragon.
Be prepared to greet your High King!
This is madness, Logan! The man's a Verdmeister! You can't face him!
Hey, Maburu! Nice tattoo!
Logan drew his sword. His right arm felt burning heat. Logan looked down. The incandescent green pattern etched into his arm had melted through the chainmail of his sleeve. It burned as bright as the moon dragon's eyes. Logan caught one glimpse of fear in Maburu's face before Maburu's skin was overwhelmed with black knots of fear. Maburu threw out a hand, and a gout of magic leapt for Logan. Burst from Logan's arm to meet it. All Logan saw was rushing scales and the burning green of the moon dragon's eyes, as if the entire creature had taken up residence in his arm and was now springing free full size. Its mouth snapped shut on Maburu. Then it disappeared. Maburu stood immobile. At first, Logan thought the moon dragon had been illusory or his imagination. It appeared to have done nothing at all to his opponent. Then, every tracery of fear within Maburu's skin shattered. With a dragon's strength, Logan swung his sword down on the pretender. It caught Maburu in the crown of his head and sheared through him. Before the halves of Maburu's body hit the ground, Dee was on top of the Verdmeister holding the death spell on Janine. He and every other Kaladoran and Lord Drakkari and Wild Man on the balcony raised their hands slowly. The death spell dissolved. The Kaladorans dropped to their knees and looked at Logan with something in their eyes uncomfortably close to worship.
Battle Mistress!
It was the old mage who'd killed the Farali. His eyes were unfocused. He smelled strange to Logan's sensitive nose.
Battle mistress! You're needed in the Hall of Winds! Come quickly, or Mikiru is dead!
Then he looked at Logan.
High King! Summon every man you'd have lived to see the night!
Janine was staring at the madman with horror.
Who is this man?
The mage made it onto the balcony. He held a thick gold chain in his hands, but abruptly seemed lost.
Dorian! Gods, what have you done?
Not dead, but
he's a prophet. What he speaks is true. There's no time, Your Majesty. We must go. Neff's done it. Damn him. He's broken Jorson's spell.
Solon was staring at the black dust that covered everything within miles. It suddenly congealed, forming a thin sludge everywhere.
You're sure of this, man? You'd bet 60,000 souls on his word?
That and more.
Solon took the great gold chain from Dorian's hands and draped it over Logan's shoulders. Logan turned to leave.
Send up flares. All our armies to the castle immediately. And then get yourself there, fast.
Kyler and Durzo approached the Hall of Winds together, unlimbering their swords as one. Both men were liberally spattered with blood. They paused outside a rosewood side door.
I hate this part.
Relax, I killed 4 Werdmeisters once, didn't I?
There are 200 Werdmeisters in there.
There is that.
All right. We do the Highlanders guarding the door in no more than 5 seconds. Then you draw the Werdmeister's attention, and I go for Neff Dada. It might work.
Not likely.
Muted light flared to the tip of Kurok. Kyla threw open the door and Durzo dashed inside. The 4 Highlanders guarding the side door had their backs to them. Only after killing his 2 did Durzo allow himself to take in what everyone else was staring at. The Hall of Winds was a vast circle topped by a high dome without any interior supports. The entire panorama of the ceiling and the walls themselves was imbued with magic. Looking east, it was as if the walls weren't there. You could see Logan's men battling a Ferrari. The presentation of what was happening outside continued as he looked south, but ended abruptly at a crack that had slithered down from the top of the dome. From south to west, the scene portrayed was of sunrise over the bustling city this once had been. It was a summer day. Ships crowded the river. The terraced hills were a tapestry of gardens, bearing 1,000 different kinds of flowers, and the city was vast beyond comprehension. Beyond the next crack was the night sky, half a moon shining brightly enough to cast shadows. Beyond that one was a narrow panel of a thunderstorm, with lightning flashing and rain falling in torrents. Other panels were dark. The magic was gone, made in plain stone, but none of these wonders were what held the Highlanders' and Werdmeisters' attention. In the middle of the domed room, the Werdmeisters stood in concentric circles around Neff Dada, who held a thick scepter. At his feet, clutching a wrinkled leather fetish, was a slobbering Tensor Ursul. Every one of the Werdmeisters held the beer, and every one of them was linked to Neff Dada, who stood at the center of a vast web of magic. Thick bands of every color disappeared into the floor and the earth itself, and he was manipulating the weight of 200 Werdmeisters' beer, expanding that web. Fires were shifting in his hands, morphing faster than the eye could follow, twisting the web, expanding parts of it, pulling parts together. Neither swordsman hesitated. Kyla dashed along the outside of the circle, his sword at neck level like a kid running a stick along a slack fence, except his stick cut throats, leaving 20 men dead. Then he leapt 10 feet in the air and light exploded from him. Durzo ran straight for Neff Dada, up one of the aisles, passing between dozens of Werdmeisters. He was within 5 paces of the witch when Neff raised a hand. Durzo stopped instantly. He couldn't even bounce backward. Magic wrapped him everywhere. Neff extended his hand again and air gelled in a wall, cutting off Kyler and another score of Verdmeisters from the rest of the hall. Kyler plowed into them, and they, their veer still connected to Neff, could do nothing. In seconds, they were all dead. Neff returned his attention to Ayers in his left hand.
Ebrimus nunquam terminus
felium. Ayers morphed again into retribution. Neff wrapped liver-spotted fingers through Tensor's hair and cut his throat open. Blood spilled all over the leather fetish Tensor held, hissing and spitting as if it were white hot. Tensor pitched over, dying as the magic released.
It is finished! All Jorsin's works are broken. Kali comes.
He turned to Durzo. With a gesture, the bonds holding Durzo fell away.
You must be Durzo Blint. Or should I say, Prince Achilles Thorn? Oh? Surprised? The Society of the Second Dawn has let its standards for membership slip, I'm afraid. I know all about you, Durzo Blint. Even that you gave up the Black Kakari. Poor choice.
Seemed good at the time. We gonna do this or not?
No.
Neff turned to Kyler and gave a little mocking bow.
Well met, Kyler Stern, Godslayer, Kakarifer. You're not using the Black Kakari. Why?
Lost it in a card game.
Not a very good liar, are you? When a Kakari is surrendered willingly, it must serve its new master. They can be broken, but it takes time. I'm an old man. I'd like to bond the Black as soon as possible, but I can take it from your corpse if need be. If you don't give it to me, I'll kill your master. If the Society's right, this time, he won't come back.
My master understands about necessary sacrifices.
There you have it!
A sliver of magic jutted out of Durzo's chest. Neff had stabbed him from behind. The magic faded, and Durzo stood, weaving.
Dishonorable.
What's honor? A 90-year-old man fighting you with a sword?
But Durzo made no reply. He was already dead. Kyler made a wordless sound of protest, staring at the corpse with disbelief. It was like seeing the sun set at noon. He'd known that Durzo would die someday, but not now. Not so easily. Not without a fight.
One more chance. Give me the Black Kakari. That's all I want. I'll leave you to Kali. You may even escape.
Kyler drew himself to his full height and rolled his shoulders, loosening his muscles for action.
That sounds like a great deal. But there's three problems. First, I'm not Kyler.
His face morphed into one leaner, pockmarked, with a wispy blonde beard. He was Durzo Blint.
Second, that corpse isn't Durzo.
What?
Third, if someone would move his ass...
Neff turned belatedly. In a smooth motion, the corpse stood and was Kyler. Skin sheathed in black metal, face covered by the Mask of Judgment, Kurok sliding out of his fists as white-hot claws. Kyler punched. Claws of Kurok crossed on either side of the Verdmeister's spine, 8 bloody points poking out of his back.
Third, I'm not dead.
Kyler lifted Neff off the ground. The veer leapt to the surface of every inch of Neff's skin. White light blasted through every vein of veer. Kyler ripped the claws in opposite directions, shearing the Verdmeister in half. The walls surrounding Durzo evaporated into nothing, and there was silence in the Hall of Winds.
Kylo sheathed Kurok on his back and gingerly picked up Ayers. He tossed it to Durzo.
You could have given me a few more seconds. You just taught me rapid healing 10 minutes ago. What if I hadn't got it right on the first try?
Kylo looked at the dome hundreds of feet overhead, swaying out of time with the ground. At Kylo's feet, he saw the focus through which Neff had been pulling all the power he'd worked on with Ayers. It was a leather bundle, ancient, cracked and yellowing, with gems sewn to it and a horrid, desiccated, hairless, boneless skull grinning formlessly from the front. It could only be one thing. This horror was Kali. He hefted Kurok and jammed its point through the fetish. The section of the floor beneath the fetish in Kurok sank. Kylo stepped back and the floor opened like a coffin lid. There was a woman inside. Her hair was long and blonde, carefully arrayed in small braids and curls. Her long lashed eyes were closed, her cheeks flushed, full lips pink, skin flawless alabaster. For some reason, to Kylo's eyes, the girl was a collection of details that refused to coalesce into a woman. A familiar dimple here, the sweep of her neck. Her dress was white silk, slim cut to her figure, backless. More daring or more scandalous than anything Aline would have worn.
Aline! Aline!
Her lips curved into a smile. Lovely brown eyes opened. Kyla's knees went weak. She reached out her regal hand, and when he took it, she rose almost magically to her feet. Every move spoke perfect grace.
You don't have any scars.
I can't stand ugliness. I want to be beautiful for you, Kylo. I need Kurok.
He looked into her smiling face and was lost. Through the Kakari, Aline looked like an archmage. Magic swirled thickly around her. Aline wasn't talented, but this was Aline. His heart froze. Distantly, he heard the main doors of the hall bang open. His knees hit the floor.
Kylo! No!
Kylo watched the doors open wide. Following V was Logan, one arm glowing green. Solon, Logan's old advisor, wearing a crown. The mountainous Fear Kasat. Four Magi, all greatly talented. Dorian the Prophet, Lord General Brant Agon, and Captain Caldrosa Wynne with 50 of Agon's dogs. The scent of Aline filled Kylo's nostrils as she stepped close. What had she done? His eyes snapped open as Aline snatched Kurok from his limp fingers. The look in Aline's eyes was foreign. She looked intoxicated as she gazed at the blade.
Trace, that's enough!
Achilles? No, it can't be.
Hand it over, Trace. And the White Kakari too. Release the girl's body.
It is you.
What happened to you, Trace? You were one of the champions. Joss entrusted you. We all did. What have you become?
I am Kali.
At the word, the Verdmeisters dropped to their faces.
Look at my pets. So humble. And every one of them scheming even now.
She looked around the Hall of Winds. She gestured with Kurok, and every crack in the dome was sealed. The scene unified. A spring day. Mountains purple in the distance. Flowers everywhere.
Do you remember this, Achilles? We were supposed to be married here.
Her white dress shifted like liquid metal, shimmering into a high-necked full green gown with thousands of crystals sewn into it.
You were beautiful.
I was a hag. Bad teeth, bad skin, crooked back. Then Ezra gave me the White Kakari. I heard you quarreling with him. You betrayed me first, Achilles. You left me here in my wedding gown, shamed me in front of everyone. I waited hours. I was finally beautiful, and all you were was jealous.
Durzo's face was gray, and bits and pieces that Kyler had heard over the years fell into place. To save the Black Akari and keep its incredible power secret, Jorson had given it to the betrayer, Achilles. Achilles hadn't even been able to tell his fiancée that he had it, and knowing that he would soon have to act the betrayer, Achilles had fled rather than marry. All without a word of explanation. Kylo remembered Durzo snarling at him when he was a child.
I will not allow you to ruin yourself over a girl.
Mama Kay had said women had always been Durzo's downfall. The wolf had said Durzo had once done something worse than take money for a death. Kyler had guessed it was suicide, but it was worse than that. Knowing the price of immortality was that someone he loved died in his place, Durzo had killed himself, hoping to kill Trace. But Trace, an archmage in her own right and the smartest of the champions, had figured out a way around the Black Kakari's death sentence.
Achilles and I always knew there was something strange about that death. We knew she fought the magic for months, but then her body died. We tried never to think of her again.
Jealous? I had the Black Kakari, the most powerful of them all. Ezra and I quarreled because he gave you a Kakari that confirmed a lie you believed. You weren't ugly then, Trace. You're ugly now. Look what you've done. For 7 centuries, the North has labored under your darkness. This is what Trace Arvagulinia turned her mind to. This is what you created. Why?
For immortality.
Kyla could tell the Kakari was understanding for the first time.
The White Kakari can create a glamour so powerful it can be used for compulsion. She tried to turn her Kakari into a dark imitation of me, using it to compel worship, and then trying to steal life from her willing worshippers. But it didn't work, because the soul of my magic is love, and love cannot be compelled. Trace has been disembodied until she could find someone who loves in a way that is totally foreign to what she has become. Someone willing, without compulsion, to let Trace have her body.
Now she'd found that person at long last. Aline.
Why? I do it because I wish it. I am Kali. I am goddess. Someone has to pay the price for immortality. Tell me, Achilles, who's paid for yours?
Too many people. Come, Trace. Our time is done.
My time has just begun.
Kurok became a slender staff in her hand, and she raised it. A black cloud exploded in every direction, then disappeared. The walls of the Hall of Winds became clear as glass, showing the dark battlefield to every side.
Do you remember when Jorson faced the grand armies of the Fallen? He could have stopped them if he'd listened to me. He didn't have to fight them. He could have controlled them. He was a greater mage than Roygaris. These armies could have been Jorson's. He could have simply taken them from Roygaris. We could have won.
As she spoke, it slowly became clear that the sudden darkness on the battlefield was moving, standing up. The black blanket was countless thousands of Krull corpses rising from 7 centuries of death, standing, healing, and moving into ranks. Earlier in the day, even with 150,000 men and Krull fighting, all the armies together had occupied only a wedge of the plain south of the Hall of Winds. At Kali's gesture with Kurok, Krull rose in a writhing black ocean, north, south, east, and west, as far as the eye could see. Kyla saw the titan he'd killed get back to its feet. Dozens more like it stood around the battlefield. Beasts that dwarfed even Harani bulls rose. Birds great and small rose in clouds. Fire ants by the thousands. Flying beasts. Beautiful fanged children. Brute wolves. Great cats. Horses with bone sides extending from each shoulder. Ferali by the hundreds. Kyla's mind couldn't take it all in. Jorson had faced this?
The Allied armies had reached the hall, and now they turned outward, back to back, guarding the hilltop in a circle dwarfed by the numbers of Krull they were about to face.
I can banish them. All of them. But I need Ayurs to banish the strangers. What do you say, Achaeus? Will you watch everyone you love die a second time?
You'll not have Ayurs from my hand.
So be it. Kyla, kill him! Kill all of them!
The words washed over him with the whip crack of authority. He recognized it as a compulsion spell even as he rose to obey. The spell was the full-grown oldest sister to the spell Gareth had laid on V, akin to the glamour V had used on him the first time they'd met when she'd tried to kill him. But where that glamour had been anchored only by V's attractiveness, this compulsion hit every note from lust to awe at standing in front of another immortal, a goddess. It pulled on his adoration for Aline, his loyalty and trust for her as his wife. She was princess, goddess, immortal, lover, companion, wife, and all those bonds were amplified 100-fold through Kurok. There was no question of disobedience. Kyla stood. The Black Akari formed twin swords in his hands. It was trying to speak to him, tell him how to combat the magic she was bombarding him with. But to use the Kakari, he had to want to use it, and the compulsion stole his very willpower. He looked into Aline's big eyes, and nothing mattered but pleasing her. Even as his heart despaired, and he wanted nothing more than to throw himself on his own swords, he wanted to please her more.
Galar! Stop! You!
He advanced alone from among the Magi. The command flashed like lightning through Kyla's compulsive wedding earring to the core of his being. It felt like he'd been falling from a great height only to have a rope tied around his wrist suddenly stop his fall. Kali paused, surprised. She looked at V.
Dear girl, don't you know what happens when a woman contends with a goddess?
She turned to Kyla and put a hand on her stomach.
My love, you wouldn't betray the mother of your child, would you?
He couldn't breathe. Aline's stomach was indeed slightly swollen. His child. The sudden delight on Kali's face told him it was true. Aline was pregnant. She'd known. She hadn't told him. The new claim to his loyalty added another layer to the power of the compulsion spell.
Darling, kill them. Starting with that slut.
Kyla felt himself being torn between compulsions like a man on the rack. One of the mages chose that moment to loose a fireball. It fizzled before it went an arm's length. Kyla made a little snatching motion, and Kyla saw every Glor Virden in the room emptied in an instant. He fell to her knees, concentrating on him, sending strength to him. She reached for the nearest elements of their bond, his guilt at what he'd put her through, how he owed her better, and his desire for her. Kali matched those and overmatched them. Kali tugged on what he owed Aline, on his desire for her, on the moments they'd shared making love. The compulsion spell worked by magnifying whatever hold a person had, whether authority or love or lust or obedience. Fueled by the might of Kurok, it almost obliterated Kyla's mind. Kyla raised his swords and started walking toward V. He could feel Kali's triumph, her pleasure at her mastery of him. V's eyes held his as he walked closer. She reached up and pulled out the band that held her braid. Her hair spilled down like a cup of waterfall. For the first time in her life, V made no attempt to protect herself, no attempt to cover this one thing that she had kept private as she had lost all else. She spread her open hands and dropped the threads of lust and guilt in their bond. Kyla saw her then as he'd never seen her before. He saw the nights of agony with which she had paid for his nights of pleasure with Aline. He saw how gladly she'd done that for him, and at what cost.
I love you, Kylar.
He loved him fiercely. Kyla missed a step as he clung to that single cord. Love, with all her might. She looked up at him as he drew the twin swords back.
I love you, Kylar.
Then, Impossibly?